to war in Indochina. They again began under Eisenhower, but I don't think he was aware of them. In fact, the first key decision was made when he was on a golf course in Scotland playing golf as part of a priest. So why did a decision have to be made on that particular day? Because Richard Nixon could make it when Eisenhower wasn't. This is not the only case of that happening.
So they were using the president basically as a figurehead and leaving him out of the loop on these key decisions.
Right.
But here's what I think is interesting about this era of the deep state. We have Eisenhower warning about these forces in his speech. Then you have Truman denouncing the CIA that he set up after Kennedy is assassinated.
Right.
You know, and Truman says, I didn't create the CIA to be this out-of-control agency. And then you have President Kennedy, who said he was going to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces. So all of these presidents who work closely with intelligence are saying that this covert influence in CIA is a threat to American freedom, basically.
Carter said that it was his policy to reduce the size and strength of the CIA, and Turner did it mostly by taking early resignations and so on.
Mm-hmm.
There were people in the agency who felt targeted by him, rightly so, and I mentioned Shackley before, I'll mention him again.
Mm-hmm.
And Theodore Shackley, he was eased out. He wasn't exactly fired, but he was made uncomfortable. He left, and he immediately joined up with the people who were working in the Safari Club to conduct offshore operations that didn't have to go to Congress for approval.
I see.
So, and Carter is another victim, too. Yes.
Okay, so Carter also knew they were dangerous. Well, what's fascinating is this. It looks like the deep state relied on the CIA. Then, when the CIA got into trouble in the 1970s, being investigated over and over again for these unsanctioned operations, then it sounds like the Safari Club became where the focus of the deep state went, as far as intelligence is concerned anyway. So you were saying it was almost like a government in waiting, because there were these ex-CIA figures kind of biding their time and making deals, making arrangements, waiting for that chance to get back in power and to utilize that public state for their covert planning again. Does that sound correct?
Yes, pretty much. And I want to add to it something which is not mentioned enough in my book, and this again involves Shackley, that because Congress in the 70s established congressional control over the CIA, then the military started getting involved in covert operations, and they set up something called the Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC.
JSOC.
And Shackley had a hand in that, and another man called General Stilwell, who had been fired as a result of this flap back in 1952. He was fired by Beadle Smith for his involvement in Thailand.
Okay.
Went over to the military, and one of his last actions was to be an advisor in the setting up of JSOC. And what's going on now is a lot of U.S. covert operations. And not some of them, not really so very covert, like the drone attacks, which was,
yes.
I mean, the planning is secret, but people, if there's a drone attack, it's not a secret. And the more and more these things are being handled under SOCOM, Special Operations Command, and the Joint Special, JSOC, the Joint Special. There's a whole new bunch of initials in the Pentagon
right.
to deal with this kind of warfare, which is a kind of byproduct of Congress establishing oversight over the CIA.
Okay, so I think we've tracked the deep state now to the point where Carter loses re-election in 1980. Due in part to the shenanigans around the October surprise. So then when you get into the Reagan era, and you've touched on Oliver North already, but some interesting things are happening in the Reagan era. Suddenly drug traffic explodes. There are major reports implicating the CIA in drug running. So people with connections to the deep state are firmly back in power. So we have the Contras in Nicaragua running drugs. We have Barry Seal and his ties to the drug operations in MENA, Arkansas, and the Reagan administration. Now, I know you've done some amazing research on this, and so let's get into that, because I want to show how the drugs are related, financing-wise, to the deep state.
Well, yes. I don't say enough about that in this book, because I had said a lot about it in my last book.
Yeah.
But you have to remember that the dollar was under severe attack in the 70s and early 80s because of these oil price hikes.
Uh-huh.
So when Reagan was elected president, interest rates were at 17%. The economy was in a terrible mess. And the Treasury started selling bearer bonds, which meant anybody could come in for cash, buy a Treasury bond. Well, this became the number one form of laundering of drug money. And the Treasury was advised at the time, this is going to result in the laundering of drug money. They wanted the drug money. They needed an influx of capital to help bring down the interest rates and get business back to normal. And after about 6 or 7 years, they then stopped issuing bearer bonds. But the atmosphere of drugs in the U.S. economy in early 1980s isn't just the CIA. The CIA use it. They don't get the money themselves, but they work with people who finance their own private armies with drugs. And that was the case with the Contras.
Right. So they could say that basically we're getting better intelligence this way. We have to work with these kind of lower elements in these lawless places.
Right.
And that is the public explanation for what they're doing, basically.
And if it's a lawless place where you happen to be against the government, like in Nicaragua, then you work with the leading opposition, which is usually the local drug traffickers. And that was the Bermudas and people who were the head of the Contras. Well, there were different Contra factions, and there was a drug connection to every faction, because that was one of the ways of financing the Contras. And before that, you know, the largest army that the CIA ever backed was the Hmong back in the 1970s in Laos. The CIA even gave them their own airline to help. It was to get the arms in, yes, but what did those planes go out with? The single Hmong agricultural product was opium, and this airline flew it out.
Oh, right.
So it was being established going right back to what I was talking about in the early 50s in Operation Paper. Mm-hmm. You bring arms in, and the planes bring your drugs out, and you can say we don't have anything to do with the drugs, because in the case of Operation Paper, those planes, which later were known as Air America planes, were actually 60% owned in Taiwan. So you could say, no, that's a Taiwan flight coming out. It's a CIA flight going
right,
in.
Right, right.
CIA was running the airline.
Well, you have a very interesting corollary between the drug traffic around the Vietnam War and then Afghanistan, which is the new drug war. And to a certain extent, both of these conflicts were drug wars.
Exactly. I would say that one of my books, it's a rerun of Laos.
Okay.
Yes. And, you know, we get a lot in the papers about how the Taliban are financing themselves by drugs, and they are. But everybody in Afghanistan, and certainly the established government, that is the major part of the Afghan economy, just as before it was the major part of the Laotian economy. And the head of the Laotian army was also the head of the Laotian drug agency, but drugs were actually legal. The only difference is that drugs, until 1971, were legal in Laos, whereas they were illegal in Afghanistan. But that, of course, is good for prices. That helps prices go up.
Well, one of the most interesting details that you point out, actually, is that under Taliban rule in Afghanistan, drug production had gone way down, which is amazing.
Virtually eliminated. Yes, in 1 year, bang.
Wow.
There was some drug production, but it all came from the areas which were never controlled by the Taliban up in the north. The northeast was the drug producing area in that period. And that was those people were people who became our allies against the Taliban.
So we're basically allying ourselves with the drug cartel in Afghanistan versus the Taliban.
As we did. Yes, exactly.
Right. That's fascinating. And after we got into Afghanistan, of course, suddenly the drug production level is off the charts again.
Yes, and is again now. It's huge. I don't have the figures for this year, but it went, it more than doubled from the highest year before Karzai went in. And initially, you could almost say there was a humanitarian justification for it because the country was so wrecked by 10 years of civil war that if people had not been able to grow drugs, they would have starved.
Okay.
So maybe for a year or two, you can justify allowing the drug traffic.
I see.
We've been there for over a decade, and we're going to leave the country the number one heroin producer in the world, which it wasn't before the CIA became involved in. It's very interesting, though. When we were involved in the in Southeast Asia, that was the number one opium area producing in the world. And when Nixon recognized China and cut his connections with Taiwan, and then the drug production there plummeted, at the same time, it started rising in Afghanistan. Oh. And actually, the levels, or total levels, are not all that different. I believe that there are very powerful drug forces in the world, that the CIA, they don't control these forces, but they are working with these forces. And what's interesting is that the drugs started going up in Afghanistan, and there, sooner or later, sure enough, the CIA turned up
right.
for the first time in a big way in Afghanistan. Now, Brzezinski was the advisor to Carter who authorized operations, which he himself said may lead to a Russian intervention in the Civil War. I don't know that Brzezinski knew anything about the drugs, but I think that in the deep state, there are forces that saw this whole thing coming and were able, in other words, eliminating the drugs in Southeast Asia didn't have the effect of eliminating the drug traffic. It had the effect of moving it. And the same thing has happened with cocaine in Latin America. You know, George H.W. Bush proclaimed a war on drugs in Latin America, specifically in Colombia. And I predicted in 1990, I said, if we start this war, I predict that we will have more cocaine and not less. And within 10 years, my prediction was borne out.
Wow.
Cocaine production trebled in Colombia. You want it to go down? End the drug war. But they don't want to end the drug war because it is part of the establishment of how America has a presence in the rest of the world. And yes, we need, one of my chapters is America must end its self-generating wars. What war is a self-generating war? Because you're driving profits up and more people come in. And the war on terrorism is a self-generating war because you create 10 terrorists for everyone that you murder with a drone attack.
Yes, absolutely. Well, before we leave this topic of drugs, and this is so interesting, recently there was a movie that came out based on a true story about journalist Gary Webb called Kill the Messenger. And of course, anyone into tracking this subject knew about Webb long before the movie came out because of his excellent book, Dark Alliance, where he outlined how elements in the CIA were running drugs into major American cities. And the movie came under nonstop attack in the mainstream media.
Yes, I was actually a consultant.
Oh, that's great. Well, you really know that story.
And I'm proud to say that one of my recommendations was adopted in the movie.
Excellent.
It's a very good movie. It's pretty true to, if I'm asked to say, is it essentially true? I would say, yes, it's essentially true. Why is it being attacked in the media? Because the media attacked Gary Webb. And they destroyed Gary Webb. They put him in a position where he couldn't make any money, and I think it was a suicide.
Yeah.
But it was a suicide of a man who had no income, who was starving.
Yes, I understand what you mean, that there are ways to eliminate someone without actually planning out their assassination.
Totally, yes.
Yeah, sure. But when you think about Webb, first of all, for the person who's watching this and doesn't really know much about media manipulation, why would the media want to destroy a figure like Gary Webb, who was exposing this shady network between Central American drug running and intelligence operations and potentially being involved with shipping crack into Los Angeles? Why would the media have a vested interest in taking a guy like that down?
Well, what are called the mainstream media and I call the governing media are media that work very closely with the CIA, and hardly a day goes by when you don't see a story from Washington that says a high-level official who declined to be identified said, that's the CIA putting stuff into the media.
Okay.
And the media, if you want to be an important newspaper, you depend on that connection. And the CIA does favors for the media by giving them stories that the media then thing, and the media defends the CIA, not 100% of the time, but most of the time they do. And in the case of Gary Webb, the CIA later boasted how they put out advisories to things to say about Gary Webb, and the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, they all chipped in and attacked Gary Webb, particularly scandalous in the case of the L.A. Times, because Gary Webb relied very heavily on an L.A. Times story, Ricky Ross, the King of Crack in L.A.
Right.
He used that story, and then the same reporter working for the L.A. Times then attacked Webb and said, that's a great exaggeration, the things you claim for Ricky Ross. And that same reporter, I believe, since then has somewhat repented and apologized played this double role. I had this same experience with some of the people that are mentioned in the Gary Webb book, because my job, when I worked for a little think tank in Washington in 87, and a part of it was doing research and sending stuff up to I didn't deal much with Kerry. I dealt with mostly with his executive assistant on the committee. But I also did stories to give to the press. And I began to see a pattern. These people would say, oh, yes, we're very interested. Is there anything more you know? Tell us. No, we're going to do a huge story. And then they wouldn't do the story. And the people who wouldn't do the story were the people who became the character assassins dealing with Gary Webb a few weeks later. I mean, I'm not going to name names, but I could name names. And that's their job. You know, they work for a newspaper that is part of a control system. And I think I have a small apology in my book where I say I haven't dealt with all of the aspects of the deep state because I wanted very much to look at corporations and the intervening the level of the public state and the level of the CIA and the NSA up at the very top of the corporations and the banks. And in between those are these consulting firms like Booz Allen Hamilton, which are full of people who come from the CIA and go back to the CIA or go back to industry, come from industry. They're all interacting.
And this is private intelligence contracting agencies.
Yes, I call them, you know, we have private military corporations. We have private intelligence corporations. Anyway, I don't say enough about the media because that was going in a slightly different direction, but they are part of the deep state and they have their own, you know, Ben Magdickian and people who have written about how the corporatization of the media, that it all focuses in the end on Wall Street, and people who are on the boards of the media are on the boards of the big corporations and the banks, and that is the deep state. the media are as much part of the deep state as, say, Booz Allen Hamilton is part of the deep state.
Yeah, well, you have these major media companies and TV stations in New York, along with the national newspapers there.
Right.
And we have Wall Street right in the middle of all that. And you're saying they intertwine very closely and are really part of the same mindset.
Yeah, well, I have to be careful. I'm not saying this to you. I'm saying to myself.
Oh, yeah.
You have to be very careful when you talk about the mindset, because you often see conflicts. I mean, Rupert Murdoch and News Corp and Fox News, they're on a slightly different path from, say, the New York Times and CBS News.
Right.
And when Rupert Murdoch's family got into some big trouble in England over crimes, the New York Times did a lot to expose that. So
true.
There isn't exactly a single mindset uniting Rupert Murdoch with the New York Times. But if somebody's coming from outside and challenging the whole thing, like a Gary Webb on drugs,
okay,
then they will unite to deal with him. No, they don't necessarily unite. And I think sometimes seriously disagree on should your run, for example. I think you do find some serious differences. The PNAC view on what to do in Iran is not, I think, the New York Times view of what to do on Iran. And this is a very complex and interesting area, which I may have to write a second book about or something.
Yeah. Well, I hope that you do, because I think it's important to see that the media doesn't tell us the truth. You know, too many people take it for granted that they will. But even when the media is reporting and following up on an important story, we're not getting the whole truth. You know, they're not really showing us the deeper levels.
I think somewhere I compare the media performance in the Iraq war with the media performance in the Vietnam war. The media, you know, is from basically people rather like me. I mean, all my life I've known journalists, and they're usually rather decent people, but like bureaucrats, anyone who works for an organization learns either to think the way the organization thinks or to get out. That's why I got out of government. I was beginning to think like a bureaucrat, and I could see myself beginning to think as a bureaucrat when I left. But
well, I think there's no question that there's a real danger of being absorbed.
Some very good friends stayed in, and they continue to be my good friends, even though they held to views which I now radically disagree with. Journalists are in that situation, and many good journalists have had to leave. We have one of the results is that there's now a spectrum between the governing media and people like me. There are a lot of intermediate figures like Robert Parry, for example, who broke the story on Contras and drugs, and he broke a number of other stories. And people who were breaking stories back in that era were eased out of the media, and he now has something called Consortium News, which is an excellent self-supporting news agency. He doesn't agree with me about 9/11. He's blasting people who say that there's a conspiracy behind 9/11. But so he's in an intermediate position.
I see.
I'm very glad he's there, and he's been very good on the Ukraine and on U.S.-Russian relations. And
well, it's interesting, and this reminds me of someone like Bill Moyers, who plays a very dual role. You know, because you could say Bill Moyers on one side of things was an insider, a special assistant to LBJ, and had a deep connection and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. But he also did some incredible work
yes.
as a journalist, exposing a lot of political corruption in a special documentary. And this is quite a while ago now, but it was called The Secret Government.
I was supposed to be a major source for that movie. The producers told me 1 week before that I was going to have a big role in that movie. And when I watch it, there were the things I had said, but somebody else said them.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
I think I'm not really a totally acceptable person to the media.
Yeah.
And I'm glad. I mean, I'm happier to be where I am than to be somebody reading somebody else's lines.
No, I understand that. And since you've mentioned it, actually, I've seen your work plagiarized so often when dealing with covert political reporting and just used in a variety of ways.
I want it to be disseminated.
Yeah, but this is without sourcing it or saying who they're getting it from. You know, most of the time people don't credit it back to your body of research. And I'll see it pop up in everything from New York Times articles to, you know, New World Order websites. And sometimes it's word for word based on your books on deep politics.
Well, I'm not alone. There are other people like me, and we're all in this situation. Bill Moyers, for example, he had an excellent show with a man called Lofgren about the deep state.
Right.
Now, I didn't mention that I used the deep state in 2007, but no, I want the idea of the deep state to get out there, so I'm quite happy not to be cited.
I know what you mean. And actually, it is a fascinating thing. You know, when I saw this guy going around with his book on the deep state, I said, oh, they must be interviewing Professor Scott. You know, that's the first thing that popped into my head. But when I watched the shows, he was only talking about Republicans and Democrats and all that, you know, nothing edgy and just a totally different version of the whole thing. But using the title, the same title from your books.
You know, I'm not against it. There's a book out almost simultaneously with mine. A man called Michael Glennon has brought about a book out called National Security and Double Government. He's talking about what I would call the two outer layers of the deep state onion. He's talking about Congress, the president at one level, and then the CIA, what he calls, I think, the Trumanite network. Because he blames Truman for setting these things up. He doesn't, I guess, take very seriously Truman's claim that he didn't intend to
okay.
What has since happened. So it's a good book, but he doesn't talk about Wall Street. He doesn't talk about banks. He doesn't talk about drug trafficking. He's a political scientist.
Uh-huh.
He's talking about structures. And in my own book, so Michael Lofgren says, is it Michael? Yeah, I think so. Lofgren says that the deep state is like an iceberg, and you only see the top level of it that goes way, way down. And that's a good metaphor in terms of suggesting the sort of size of the problem we're dealing with. But it's a bad metaphor because the deep state is not a structure. It's not something solid like an iceberg. At the end, and I distinguish between the structures. Now, the CIA is a structure, Congress is a structure, but when you're talking about Wall Street, it's not a structure in the same sense. And so I talk there about a system, a solar system, or even better, a weather system.
A weather system, yeah.
A weather system is something you can't precisely say where it stops and where it ends. But it can be very forceful, and you can have a Hurricane Sandy from, and it can be devastating.
Right.
So I think we're dealing with forces that are not all structured and are not predictable. They interact in different ways.
I see. That's very interesting. Well, in your new book, you talk about how over time it has come down to two different worldviews, really. With two competing mentalities. And so on one side, we have a kind of bottom-up democracy versus a top-down empire.
Right.
Now, can we talk a little bit about that? Because it seems to me to be the foundation of the book, really, the clash of these two intense forces.
Yes, well, that's a thought that I took from Hannah Arendt. And actually, to be really honest, I took it from a man called Jonathan Schell, who adapted Hannah Arendt's ideas into a powerful defense of nonviolence and the vision that the bottom-up powers, the powers of persuasion as opposed to the powers of coercion,
mm-hmm.
are growing. And in my last chapter, I come back to that theme and say that I believe many of my friends here in Berkeley, the left coast,
yes,
they're very depressed about America. And I'm a Canadian, first of all. I don't take heart I don't get as depressed as Americans do things go wrong in this country, because yes, I'm involved and I care deeply, but I'm also, part of me sees it a bit from outside. And looking from outside, I see that America's had this kind of crisis before. We really are in a period of mania, insanity, in right now. America's gone crazy about terrorism and is responding in ways which are increasing the terrorism. And some people are very happy to do that because it's intensely profitable to some people. But America's been in periods of mania before and has rectified itself.
Yes. Well, what are some of the self-perpetuating factors that are keeping America in this off-balance state?
We have a very small percentage who are profiting at obscene rates from what's going on right now. And we have many people say we have a new Gilded Age, referring to the late 19th century. But America took care of that. It took a Republican president.
Right.
And after starting with Theodore Roosevelt, income disparity and wealth disparity in this country began diminishing and diminishing and diminishing. And that was true right up until 1980 and the Reagan Revolution, when it started going back very radically in the opposite direction.
Uh-huh.
Well, I believe that the long-term process of history, and this is sharing my idea from Jonathan Schell, that in the long run, the forces of persuasion are increasing. They were nothing to begin with. History for a long time was not a history of persuasion. It was a history of coercion.
True.
But we've had events in American history recently. One of them was the anti-war movement that essentially from below helped, not by itself, of course, but helped persuade America to get out of Vietnam. A much more inspiring example is the civil rights movement.
Yes.
Essentially, it was a movement of persuasion. It persuaded whites in the South that they did not want, that it was not in their interest to perpetuate Jim Crow and the prevention of Negroes from voting. It was in their interest to be part of the world as a whole, which disapproved so radically of that situation.
Right.
So that's my last chapter, that the long trend in history is persuasion dominating, whereas in the short term, it's usually coercion dominating, and right now it is coercion dominating. But that is self-defeating, I think, not permanent.
I see. It's their short-term solution, but you see historically.
Term, but it's short-term. Yes, shorter than the other.
Right. So you're saying historically, America has a chance to turn things around.
America is not, I hear some people saying America is a fascist country. No, it's full of people. I mean, in a fascist country, you and I wouldn't be talking on TV.
That's true. And it's important that we are very specific when we use terms like that. I agree 100%. But on the other hand, we are talking about trends here, like the militarization of the police that you referenced earlier and the privacy violations we see happening in contracting agencies for intelligence. So what do you see are some of the biggest dangers going on, in addition to what we've covered here so far?
Well, I think it's the accumulation of wealth in the hands of very few people. And particularly since the Supreme Court decision, where money now can turn up anywhere. And that in the short run, I think we will see this Keystone Pipeline, which is a disaster from an environmental point of view. So the money problem is so acute that you might say that's a difference between now and the Theodore Roosevelt era, that America was able to right itself because there wasn't money concentrated in, say, 100 people or something like that. I've heard it said, I don't know if it's true or not, but that the richest people in the country all know each other or are in touch with each other. And if that's true, they can throw their money, but even so, we're still seeing divisions. You know, I mean, one of the largest fortunes squandered in the last election was somebody who was spending his own private money, about $60 million of it, to support candidates who were willing to speak truth to power on the question of global warming.
Yeah.
And in the short run, he lost. But he didn't really lose all that money. It was a step in a process that someday, I mean, either we're going to get smart about global warming, or it's the end. You know, it's not, the culture we're in now is not maintainable unless it can readjust its relationship to the forces of nature.
So I can see from what you're saying that you do have a kind of central optimism for America. And after all, the book is called American Deep State. So you're speaking specifically about America in there.
Yes.
But the trends that you're seeing in America, like you said before, you know, we're in a kind of mania now.
Right.
And, you know, it's almost like McCarthyism or other stressful periods where the official structure just overreached. And, you know, another example would be the anti-war movement.
Yes, or at 1919 in the Palmer Raids, which was
a
blot on U.S. history, but it ended up with Hoover being told not to do that sort of thing. And
right. Well,
I mean, it's a complex story again, but yes, there are things. The short term, reading the paper from day to day, one is rationally, I think, compelled to be a pessimist.
Okay.
But reading American history in the long run, there's room for hope, not so much for a rational prediction that things will go well, but there's room for a hope that they will go well, a room for faith that America is a much better country than the present government we now have, Democrat or Republican. And room for to love this country, which I do. I mean, I'm here by choice. I love it. Unfortunately, they've never deported me. So I see so much advantage here that we are all, I think, very fortunate to be in this country, which gives us the opportunity to try and change this country. And that's the whole idea of what America is, a project, a way to make the city on the hill come into being. Anyone who says we are the city on the hill is a liar. But that we have the chance to become it. Yes, I think America, I say in one place that I'm an exceptionalist as a Canadian. I see America as being exceptionalist. I think it was exceptional when it created the Constitution, which was a beam of light to Europe and other parts of the world. And we're exceptional now in the number of prisoners we have in our jails,
yeah.
Number of people below the poverty line. I mean, it's a bad moment in otherwise generally noble, if imperfect, history.
Definitely. I can appreciate that. There's no question that greatness lies in our power if we can start to take control of these institutions that really need to be answerable to people. And also expose these deep state forces that are usurping the public interest.
Right.
Well, Professor, moving into our final segment, and it's just extraordinary what you've shared here today. I noticed that you started the American Deep State book with a fantastic quote by Frank Church.
Yes.
Of course, Church was the senator from Idaho who challenged the intelligence services and formed the Church Committee to look into their activities in the 70s. I was curious why you chose him and this particular powerful quote. So let's play the quote first, and then when we come back, you can tell me why you chose it.
Yeah.
I know the capacity that is there to make tyranny total in America, and we must see to it that this agency, the National Security Agency, and all agencies that possess this technology operate within the law and under proper supervision so that we never cross over that abyss. That is the abyss from which there is no return.
When I come back to deal with Church in the body of the book, it's in a context of what I see was a very important period in American history between 1960 and 1980, or more narrowly between the Kennedy assassination and the the efforts, successful efforts of ex-CIA agents to prevent the re-election of Jimmy Carter, Frank Church represented a kind of threat to the deep state at that time, because America was in chaos, really chaos, as a result of the Vietnam War, student protests, black riots in the ghettos. And then we have Watergate, and in the shambles after Watergate, it was unclear what direction America would go in. After the Vietnam War, would we reduce the defense budget and go back to the kind of civilian economy we had before? Or would we alternatively move to an extended military economy and just offshore the manufacturing that used to be done domestically? And you could say that Frank Church represented the best hopes in Congress to go in the direction by exposing things that, when I say the deep state, I mean, of course, the CIA, the FBI. He never, I think, wrote very much about the NSA, but he did look at it, and he was very alarmed by what he saw. And Congress, he brought in legislation to Congress, some of which is very relevant now, like the National Emergencies Act, which said if the president proclaims an emergency, Congress has to review it within 6 months. Well, after 9/11, the president did proclaim an emergency, and that was 14 years ago, and Congress has never renewed it.
Right.
Anyway, Church saw the problems, and he offered a solution. And I sincerely believe that if Carter had been reelected, there was a good chance that there would have been more legislation. But that didn't happen because elements of the deep state, and specifically in my book, I name the oil companies, together with the so-called October surprise counterplot of the Republicans, which involved not just ex-CIA agents, but also people from Israel and from Iran. What happened at the end of those two decades is that the deep state, having been challenged by Church and others, emerged actually. Because there was a struggle at that time, and essentially the deep state won the struggle. So starting with the Reagan Revolution, it's a thesis of my book that the deep state has been in much more powerful position than before. And we're talking something like the Kennedy assassination. That was a deep state act against the public state. But since the Reagan Revolution, the deep state has been so ensconced in the public state that you haven't seen those kind of tensions between them that we saw so vividly between 1960 and 1980.
Yes, and that's very compelling. One of the things you point out is that the presidency itself got into major problems when the deep state got the upper hand after the JFK assassination, and that the presidency didn't really regain its footing until Reagan was elected in 1980. And the deep state was finally at peace to have Reagan in there.
Exactly. I mean, if we look at the fates of presidents, Kennedy was assassinated. Johnson was going to run for a second term, and then he's having so much trouble with the military that he didn't. Nixon was elected for two terms, but he had to resign. And that was, I believe, Watergate has never yet been fully understood, that it was essentially a right-wing plot against Nixon preparing for the Reagan Revolution. And then you had Carter, and he was, Ford, an incumbent president, was defeated, the first one since Hoover in 1932, and Carter became the second incumbent to be defeated. So it was a bad time, you know, for the presidency and for the country. I mean, it wasn't all the deep state. There were problems. I mean, losing a war is a traumatic event. I mean, in France, it was the end of the Fourth Republic. So we didn't have anything quite as violent as that.
Uh-huh.
But we had cultural shocks from all of the confusion at that time, which have changed the the country, and some of those changes weren't fully implemented until 9/11. But we are now in a different country from where we were in the 50s.
Well, that's definitely true. And I think the direction we're heading in now is not too promising, not currently anyway. Finally, Professor, I was hoping to have you share this very interesting personal anecdote of a strange incident that happened to you and Alfred McCoy, also a great author.
Yes.
And so I believe this takes place in the 70s, and someone had called you and informed you that they had some special information they wanted to share with you.
Actually, I called them.
Okay.
This is the opening of the American war machine. Yes, and it is a personal anecdote, and it's a deep event, but a very small one.
Right.
Al McCoy and I both came out with books mentioning the CIA and the drug traffic in 1972. And my book was a book that you could not find in bookstores. And his book became very much thing. Both of us actually got some help from people in the CIA. What happened here was I had gone to a Winter Soldier hearing earlier, or about a few months earlier, and heard somebody talk about loading bales or watching bales of opium being loaded onto Air America planes, CIA planes. And when Al came out, he went to Laos and did magnificent work. I mean, his book had a lot of stuff in it, way beyond mine. On his way to Laos, he stayed with me here in Berkeley. And I phoned I had the number of the man who had talked about seeing these bales of opium being loaded on a plane. And I said, would you be willing to talk to the two of us tomorrow? And he said, sure. He was in Palo Alto, not far away. So we had that phone call. And as far as I know, there had never been any thought of this happening until Al came out and I suggested it, and I made the phone call. And then the next morning we got in the car, we drove to Palo Alto. And as I remember it, and by the way, I completely forgot about this, so I'll come back to that.
Uh-huh.
But as I now recall it, we went up the stairs, knocked on his door, and he came out like this, motioning to be silent. And then pointing down the stairs, we went back down the stairs. We came to his red MG. And there was a hole this big in the steel door of his MG.
Wow.
Like this. And then he pointed to the flooring in his MG, which was wood. And he said, and now he's talking, he got away from his house, and he says, look at the floor, it is barely scorched. He said, that had to be an implosion device set by some of the people in my old unit.
Huh.
So what does this mean? This means that somebody overheard our phone conversation, and it ended up with somebody blowing a hole in his door in order to terrorize him into not talking, because he wouldn't say a word to us because he had been given the message. Now, the real reason I tell that story is not just to say that there's an interaction between people who listen to phone calls and people who blow holes in doors,
uh-huh,
but the reaction of Al and me. I was writing about what's wrong with this country. I didn't remember that memory. I completely suppressed that memory because it was just too big to fit with everything else in my mind. And I didn't recover it until about 20 years later. I was writing a poem called Coming to Jakarta, which the subtitle of which appropriately is a poem about terror. And without getting into the subject matter too much of the thing, I was recovering memories that I had suppressed. And I realized that we all live by suppressing memories. And that's how we stay sane, because there's so much in the world that would drive us insane if we took it seriously. Just the poverty of people in this country, for example.
Yes.
I mean, we don't really keep that in our minds. It's an intolerable situation. Well, I recovered the memory myself by writing the poem. The next time I saw Al, I asked him about it to see if he had suppressed it. And as I was pretty sure, he had suppressed it too. And to this day, his memory, the latest edition of his masterpiece book, The Politics of Heroin, deals with this episode by quoting my poem.
Wow.
That's a way of dealing with it. So that there are things we repress that we have to recover. That's why I began by saying that, yes, the deep politics is the product of a system of society which is so unjust that we repress a great deal of what's going on. And the process towards a more healthy, open society will be to recover the repressed memories that will undo some of the products of that repression, like the state of emergency we're in right now, for example, to bring it up to the present. So I think that's the anecdote you wanted, and that's why I think it is a really sort of, it represents in a small way, because it was a deep event. I don't understand it fully. I don't think it was CIA. Remember, I said the CIA was actually giving us information because it was 1971 is the year that Nixon is about to recognize, go to Beijing and lead to a normalization of China. And that will mean cutting connections to the Kuomintang drug traffickers in Southeast Asia. But somebody didn't like what was going on.
Amazing. That's just so off the charts and really shows you how these people operate. Now, you've had to endure a fair amount of surveillance also for dealing with these sensitive political subjects.
I was then, but they didn't make a secret of it then. I think I still am, but they're more sophisticated now.
Sure.
There was a case where an email with some sensitive material disappeared out of my mailbox in my computer.
Yeah, okay.
And simultaneously with the email I'd sent to somebody else. That's how I learned, because it disappeared from his mailbox.
Oh.
And he asked me about it, and I said, well, I'll give it to you again. It was gone from my mailbox.
Mm.
That's a pretty tiny thing. I mean, I don't feel oppressed by that.
And you've shared the information at this point, so the books are out there.
Yeah.
They know what you're about.
I want the surveillance. I've always said this. I want them to know what I'm doing because I'm nonviolent.
Yes.
If I became a citizen, I would swear not to overthrow the government by violence, and I would probably also swear to try to overthrow it by nonviolence. But I'm not going to become a citizen, so it's not relevant.
Yes.
But I want them to know. I want the CIA and the FBI and the government to know. I'm not happy about having a private intelligence corporation do surveillance on me, SAIC, for example, because for them there's a profit motive. If they say this man is dangerous and we need to up the surveillance on him, it's profitable for them.
Definitely.
So that's going to contaminate their reporting on me. But if it's the FBI and the CIA, go ahead. I read my computer. There's nothing in there that will get me arrested, I think.
It's interesting that you mentioned a private intelligence corporation doing surveillance. You know, my mind jumps to Blackwater, which is called Academy now with an I at the end. Of course, we use those guys a lot in Iraq, and even though they got into a lot of trouble when their people were just out of control over there, but Obama still contracts with them for hundreds of millions of dollars. But you've done a lot of research that's very intriguing on their founder and his family connections. Do you recall this?
Oh, yes. Eric Prince, we're talking about.
Right.
He comes from a staunchly Republican family. He married into another staunchly Republican family. And I think it was his wife's family, some member of it, boasted that they had given more money to the Republican Party than any other family. So what this really meant was, by outsourcing government money to Blackwater, you were generating profits, which then came back in to reinforce the mindset that wants to have lots of government operations overseas. So that's the danger of this.
I see, yeah.
You know, the military-industrial complex, when Eisenhower wrote about it, it was important, but it wasn't the dominant economy. he wrote it with, I'm sure, the encouragement of people from the civilian economy who shared this concern that the military economy was eroding and corrupting the civilian economy. And look what's happened. Now, all of our manufacturing, virtually the old manufacturing, has gone overseas. And the people who were architects of that were people who were part of this story of the deep state that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But it was still a competition. Now it's not a competition. Now we are a militarized economy. And to fight our way out of that is not going to be easy. But luckily, we still are incredibly rich in this country with innovators.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm on the edge of it here in Berkeley. Across the bay is Silicon Valley and Stanford.
Oh, yeah.
We have to draw on all that kind of energy and apply it to not to the problem of tracking down poor, impoverished Muslims in the northwest provinces of Pakistan, apply it to the problem of global warming and alternative energy.
Yes, well, you make a great point that we need to use these advances in technology to make a better world and not misuse this kind of opportunity.
Yes.
And that's what's so great about your new book, because it really is the culmination of all your fearless investigating over the years with all that incredible research that you've done. And on that note, I wanted to tell you that I found a clip of you interviewing Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry on the grassy knoll. Now, this is a classic clip from the 70s, and you were asking him about what happened there. Now, he was in charge of the JFK investigation originally.
Yes, he was in the car.
Right. So we're going to play that clip, but first I wanted to ask you if you remember that day and interviewing him.
Well, I have to respond two ways. First of all, you never let me, you don't give me time to say you're exaggerating when you say I'm fearless and things like that. But I'm not very fearless, no. I do fairly safe things. And I just want to comment about that camera that took that interview. It was a camera from Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Or no, excuse me, the National Film Board.
Okay.
No American network would have allowed that sort of thing. It showed on Canadian television and actually showed I don't know what parts of the show were taken up, but parts of the show were shown in Britain, France, Germany,
yeah,
all over the world, except, of course, in the United States.
Unbelievable.
A public broadcasting station took an option on the show and sat on it forever. And so America was the one country which was not allowed to see that film of Police Chief Curry.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, let's see what they were trying to hide. Here's the clip of you and Chief Curry. Here we go.
Curry saw approximately right along here, I would say.
You didn't look back at that point?
No, I looked in the rear view mirror.
I see. Now, you've seen the Zapruder film that was taken from up this hill. Now, there's a very distinct head snap where the President Kennedy's head is hit backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that suggest that the shot would have come from the
It would appear to be so.
Mm-hmm. And at the same, we also have Dr. Malcolm Perry at Parkland Hospital saying that he examined the wound in the President's throat and it was an entrance wound.
Yes.
Which would also suggest that the shot had come from the front.
I'm not saying the shot was not fired from here. I'm saying we never found anybody that we could connect with it.
But it does suggest that the evidence
right.
that we have, it's in both cases rather strong evidence, mm-hmm. that there was another assessment.
That's right.
But that won't be mine.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune by Billy Bragg and Wilco has lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Now, if you'd like to help as a reader for future episodes, do get in touch, drop me a line, or if you would like to give feedback on the show, my email address is unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net.